Kannst du nur ein Lied singen? Ja, Lied, ja. Nei, andre venstre. Nei, denne siden. Ikke til meg, til skjermen. At jeg viser på skjermen at det er så synlig. Bitte litt. Ja, sånn er det bra. Takk skal du ha. Skal vi se, Lita også på. Nå jeg spyrer den. Fire stykk. Thank you. Okay.
Two lectures left. Today is gate recognition.
Next week it will be voice recognition by Raghu. Before we start, just a small reminder that the assignment is due less than a week from now, 26th of April, midnight, so before the 27th, before Thursday. I created a folder. Show that, yeah. I created a folder here where you can deliver the term paper. Yeah? So just go here and then you'll know what to do. The 4th of May, there will be presentations of the term papers. I will set up a schedule for that. I saw previously that Christoph used 20 minutes for presentation, so from beginning to the end, so including questions. I'm not sure if we can manage that because there are so many presentations, but we'll see what we can do. Yeah, the schedule for the 4th of May is slightly different from the other days, from the normal teaching days. Yeah, that was what the administrative part that I needed to say. Then let's go and look at gate recognition. So here is again an overview. I'll start with a bit of background. I'll tell you some methods that are, I'll give a brief overview of methods that are used to do gate recognition. Experiment setups, particularly what we used to have in the past. I'll go into what gate data looks like, what we are interested in, the accelerometer data in this particular case. I'll explain the average cycle method in more detail. And then finally, I'll end with mimicking, because again, like in most cases, if mimicking is easy, then actually gate recognition cannot be very useful. And I will say something, two slides about applications of gate recognition. Let's start with the background. You all know Monty Python. You can find this on YouTube. So, Ministry of Silly Walks. We'll not say more about it. I'm not sure if you can recognize these silly walks, although they are very distinct from what other people do. But on a more serious note, Shakespeare, the writer, wrote a lot of things, and he often referred to gate recognition. One of his quotes is from the play The Tempest: "Great Juno comes, I know her by her gait." So apparently, hearing somebody walking up to him, he could recognize the sound of the walking and said, "Hey, I know who this is." So that is one of the that's certainly not the first reference to knowing that gate recognition can be done, but it is one of the earliest. Gait is a cyclic activity, right? The only thing we do in gait is put our left foot forward and then put our right foot forward. And then we'll repeat that. Left, right, etc. So here you see a gait cycle. Let's turn off this. Yeah, so we'll start. Blue means that a leg is touching the ground. Green is that it is lifted from the ground, so here the heel first touches the floor, and then the other foot is being lifted. At some point, your full body is over the standing leg, and your other leg swings forward until it has reached its maximum, and then it starts touching the ground again, and then you start here. Yeah, and the advantage of of such a flat figure is that you don't see if the green leg is the left or the right. Yeah, it can be either one. And so if this was the left leg moving forward, then we can repeat it with the green as the right leg moving forward. And then actually going over this twice is one gait cycle. So So we have our man walking. Yeah, and we see that it is a cyclic activity.
It's a small image that keeps repeating itself. So this at the bottom is just half of a cycle, of course. It's not a full cycle. A full cycle is left foot and right foot movement.
So here we see it again in the picture. We have a stance phase, which is the phase where, in this case, the right foot is touching the floor. And we have the swing phase, which is the phase where the right leg, in this case, is not touching the floor, but it's swinging forward again.
Stance phase is about 60% of the gait cycle. Swing phase is about 40% of the gait cycle.
For the other leg, it's the same. Again, the stance phase is 60% of the cycle.
And the swing phase of that leg is also 40% of the cycle.
So there is 20% of my gait cycle where actually both legs are on the ground.
I think one of the definitions of walking versus running is that at any time a leg should be touching the floor, at least a leg. In running, at some point no leg is touching the floor. No foot is touching the floor.
Names have changed slightly. For example, here it's mid stance, and it's still the same. Here it's called push off, at the point where you're pushing off your toes from the red leg in this case to leave the floor. Here it's called pre-swing. So names change a bit. Here you see a more comparison of classical and new gait terminology. Yeah, but still the same. The stance phase, the time that one leg is touching the floor, is about 60%, and the time that that leg is swinging forward is about 40% of the time. Yeah, so that's a bit about gait in general, just as a background. The various methods in which we can do gait recognition, they have developed over time. I think the oldest is actually machine vision based. Which is still a lot in use. It's machine vision, so it's a camera that is used. Floor sensor based is, as it says, there are sensors in the floor. Little research on that, but it has been done. Wearable sensor came around 2004, 2005 approximately, when that research started. And that's what we'll focus on mostly today. And then radar and sound. I found some information about that, but it's very little done. It's just a niche. So let's look at machine vision based first. Capture gait movement with a video camera. So a machine has to analyze the data. So you need some kind of video or image processing techniques. Here we see somebody walking on the video. Here we see the same area, the same surroundings, but nobody walking. So this is more or less the baseline, and then I can look at somebody walking there. And when I look at the difference between those images, everywhere where there is a difference, somebody is walking. Yeah, so this part, the left part of the image is the same, because it's black here, but here the person is walking, it's different from the background, so there I get this silhouette. Yeah? So by looking at the original image and subtracting the background, I can determine the person. I can extract the information about the person. Note that you have these soldier figures before, you played with them maybe, yeah, they have this ground floor because they need to stand. That's not this, this is shadow. Again, the shadow is not in the background of this person, it's part of his walking. So somehow there needs to be some kind of compensation for that. Notice that if this was a woman with a skirt, then all of this area would be closed. Again, these are things that need to be taken into account.
Yeah, you don't know what somebody is wearing.
Advantages of machine vision based gait recognition: it's no contact. Yeah, you don't have to do anything. You just walk there. You don't have to touch a sensor or anything. It can be captured unobtrusively. This could just be a surveillance camera that is capturing people walking by. And it is mostly used. Or it's best used for identification or forensic purposes.
You're just walking somewhere.
I'm capturing that. I'm analyzing these images. This is just one image, but you will see the silhouette actually moving from right to left in this particular case. And if I use that video part, then I can determine who this person is without him or her claiming any identity. In forensics, it has been used also. I will tell that at the very, very end. Some disadvantages: viewing direction and carrying might have an influence. If this person was wearing a backpack, all of a sudden this silhouette would look different. And I might run into trouble there if I look at the full silhouette, if I analyze the full silhouette. Viewing directions, if somebody's walking towards the camera or perpendicular to the camera or in a particular angle, there has been done research on that also, and depending on the angle, the performance is changing. It's not really suitable for authentication. I can't go to some kind of terminal, claim an identity, and then start walking in front of the camera. That's a bit odd. And obviously another problem comes if this is not the only person walking here. If there is a large group of people walking, or if people are walking from the other side, if I'm following a silhouette and somebody else is coming from the other side, I have two silhouettes nearing each other, and then they pass each other, and then they continue. Yeah, so then we have to make sure that we keep track of the correct silhouette. Yeah, that not the silhouette is followed halfway, and then we'll go over to the silhouette of the other person. So multiple persons can pose a problem. Floor sensor based. Here you see a setup where there's a lot of sensors, pressure sensors in the floor, a lot of cables also, and pressure is measured over the full size of the floor. And obviously we need to use some signal processing to process these ground reaction forces, as they were called. Again, unobtrusive. I can just have, as a part of the entrance of a building, I can have such a floor, so somebody walks over that without needing to do something special. You can use it actually for identification, but also authentication. If this would be an entrance to the building, and this would be some kind of walk path that somebody has to go over, and people go over one by one. Yeah, if I go over, I could measure my ground reaction force and determine my identity from that. Or maybe there is a small terminal at the beginning where I first have to present my token, so claim an identity, and then it's used for authentication in that case. Yeah, so I can use it both. But I guess identification is the most natural way to use this. It's expensive, it needs space. It's not easy that we transfer it to another area. Like a video camera, you take it and you put it up somewhere else and you can capture there, as long as you know the background. Yeah, but this is probably some kind of permanent structure of a building. Can handle a single person at a time. Probably if we do tracking and somebody is walking already up here, and I know that the ground reaction forces from this area are belonging to the same person, then yeah, maybe somebody else walking here can be measured also. But what if people are coming in opposite directions? Again, I have the problem of tracking the correct person all the way to the end. So that's floor sensor based. Some research on that. Wearable sensor based is we have some kind of sensor that we wear on our body and that can capture, for example, acceleration. Acceleration is the most used. You can also maybe capture gyroscope data or something like that, but acceleration data is the most used. This is from research that we have done here. Initially, we had a sensor that we could strap, for example, to the ankle or to the hip. Different versions of the sensor. Actually, this is version 2, this is version 3, which is odd because it's getting bigger, but this one was a bit unstable in collecting the data. Version 1 was a box. Yeah, how big? I don't know. This big, so quite a big box of iron. So it was a hard cover strapped to your ankle. And then, yeah,
given you some trouble in the walking. It will be painful when that is obviously attached to your ankle. Or maybe because of the ankle bone, it could start switching around also. So there were problems with that. But these smaller ones didn't give any of those problems. Those were homemade devices. This is not so much a homemade device. This is a mobile phone opened up. And inside we have accelerometers nowadays. When we started the research, 2004, 2005, we didn't have smartphones yet. Again, advantages can be unobtrusive. Your phone can measure acceleration without you. Yeah, maybe you have to turn on an application, but then you're done. Yeah, you don't need to do a lot. Very well suited for authentication. If this mobile phone is measuring how I walk, well, then this is my mobile phone. And so by default, it is my identity that I want to verify. But obviously, you can use it for identification also. If we have a tablet that is used by multiple people, then based on the walking characteristics of the one taking the tablet might decide on who's carrying it. You can imagine a hospital situation where a tablet with patient information can be taken both by a doctor and by a nurse, and the doctor should have full information about the patient. The nurse should have maybe only information about medicines. Yeah, so the nurse takes the tablet and goes around for the patients, and she looks and, okay, this patient needs this medicine. While the doctor, because of his different gait, is recognized and he will get full information about the patient. Sickness can be influenced by external circumstances. If I'm carrying again something, if I'm injured. So there are circumstances where my gait changes, and that is very much reflected in the gait signal. Radar-based, we can use a radar. Instead of a video camera, we use a radar to track people. We get pictures like this. This is apparently the human Doppler signature. You see, again, that it is some kind of a cyclic signal. This is the person walking in this direction. And so, yeah, there is something cyclic in that. They claim that they could also identify body parts. And so, just as a proof of that, I just added this picture. And another one from a person running. Obviously, nice as research, maybe not as practical because not everybody has radar equipment available. And we have sound-based recognition of persons. Yeah?
The radars, their cars now, they have radars.
So a car could use this and could... Yeah. That's true. Let's go to this one. Let's see. This is a person walking. And this is a person walking. Did you hear the difference? I can't turn it up even higher, so this is the best that we can have. The setup here was a pathway. The camera, the microphone was halfway, and so somebody walking along. And obviously, when in the beginning, the sound is soft, and then it gets harder and harder and harder, and then it gets softer again. But this was the first one. And you see here, you see in the sound signal, you see distinct points where you have the sound. The second person had a much more flat and less distinguished signal. And you hear them also, the sound sounds more continuous, like it's... It's like it's continuing all the time instead of step after step after step. Yeah? But anyway, the point is that we can hear the difference between people walking. Yeah. So we capture here the sound with a microphone, and we use signal processing, maybe voice recognition techniques or whatever, to do the processing. Again, it can be unobtrusive. Microphone can be placed anywhere without needing to do anything. Most obviously, it can be used for identification and forensics. Authentication again is a very artificial setting then. But the disadvantages are many. It's more difficult to use for authentication because, again, I have to claim an identity first and then I have to start walking. So that's odd. But I think the most problems come from the fact that there are many disturbances around. Experiments are done in a very clean environment where there is no background noise. And so, yeah. And you already hear that if the microphone is in the middle of the room and I walk from left to right, yeah, when I am at the side of the room, the sound is very weak. Only when I'm close to the microphone, yeah, the sound gets a bit higher. So many disturbances there. Okay, so those were the five methods that, as far as I'm aware of, are used in gait recognition now. Machine vision and wearable sensor are by far the two that are most used. Let's have a look at how experiments are done, experimental settings. Generally, what we do in an experiment is set up a course for people to walk. And then the participant, the one that takes part in the experiment, has to follow that course various times because I need multiple data samples. So here we see a setup at the University of Southampton where they have a special pathway inside a small passage with special colors on the wall. And research there is done by this person, Mark Nixon, and he is the guru in gait recognition. So he's the one that knows everything about gait recognition. He's the one that does the most research there. Here's the setup that they have. They have a number of cameras. There are a number of cameras for gait, 8 in total. And somebody starts walking here, so there's an entry brake beam. So once a person passes this beam, all these cameras are started. And here is an exit brake beam, so whenever I pass there, everything stops. There is also a camera for face recognition because somebody is walking in this direction, so I can capture his face also. And once he passed the end of the pathway, then also a picture of his or a video of his ear is taken, yeah, just because we can. You see here, it's difficult to see, it's a bit dark. There are 8 cameras there and you have visions from different sides. So this is probably one of these 2 cameras because I see him sideways and yeah. We see somebody walking from different angles. Here's another setup where the people are really restricted to walk from the point of the camera from the right to the left. So always one side of a person was captured. Not going back and forth, just from one side. So they walked in front of the camera and walked around the camera and repeated a number of times. Very simple, just one single view of a person. How will this system respond to somebody walking from the other side? That's unknown. How will it respond when somebody's walking not in a perpendicular angle to the camera? That's unknown. This is much more general setup. This is the same person walking but captured from many different sides. So there were 11 cameras set up, each at 18 degrees difference. So this is 0 degrees, 18, 36, 54, etc., etc. And we capture one walk in one go from 11 different angles. And this is the most, where this one, where we see somebody from the side, that's mostly used in gait recognition. But if we train a system with these kind of images, how will it respond to any other viewpoint? That's interesting research also. In our research, we
Yeah, there it is.
In our research, we mostly used a pathway, a hallway, to walk back and forth. We use accelerometer data, so somebody had some kind of device attached to some place on his body, and then he was walking, and actually didn't matter if he walked from this end to the other end of the hallway or backwards. That doesn't matter. There's no camera, it's just a device attached to the body that's capturing. Most of the research in the early days was done simple, walk in a straight line and walk back. At some point, we had a researcher who was not using the homemade device anymore, he was using the mobile phones. And then we had to take, we see this as a laboratory. This is doing experiments in the laboratory, see if gait recognition is possible. At some point, you have to look at other circumstances of walking too. You're not walking in a straight line for a full day. Yeah, you're not getting far. And so somebody had started walking here. This is actually this A building before it was remodeled. Not sure where it started. I think it started here, walking around all the way, passing through a door. That's also something we do. We come up to a door. We have to stop there, open the door, and continue in some way, or maybe not completely stop. Going through a door here again, then going upstairs, walking around there, and then at some point going down again. I'm not sure how the exact path. But you see that there is many more circumstances. We're not just walking in a straight line, we're turning corners. At some point we have to deviate from our normal pace, because there is a door, and we need to go through the door. We have to open the door at some way. We have to go upstairs or downstairs. Walking upstairs and downstairs is completely different from normal walking. And there's a number of checkpoints in between where the researcher actually made sure that he made a marker in the data, knowing that, okay, when I walk from, I'm not sure, I can't read it, from here to here, that was from 0.5 to 0.6. So he knew that that was a straight line. And you know that somewhere here was a part where somebody opened the door. So he had some knowledge about what somebody did. So in the early days, we gave people instructions how to perform the experiment. And so the instructions were walk in a straight line, walk at your normal pace, and walk as you normally do. So what happens if I give you those instructions?
You'll think about how you walk.
Yeah. Is that what you normally do when you walk?
Okay.
So you failed it. You failed this, these requirements. Yes, that's what you do. You start thinking about it. You're walking, and you say, is this what I normally do? Yeah. Actually, when you tell people to walk normally, by default, they don't do that anymore. It's not a huge deviation, of course. Yeah, but people start overthinking. The speed I'm walking, is this what I normally do? Is it maybe a bit faster, a bit slower? Early days experiments, walk at a normal pace, walk in a straight line. Those were the main things. What we then do is we record acceleration, actually, for these people. And so they were walking, I'm collecting data. At some point they came to the end of the course, they stop, turn around, and walk back. Yeah, but you see that walking one way and then turning around and walking back, actually that turning, stopping, turning around and starting to walk back, that will pollute my data. I don't need that data. I just want in a straight line at a normal pace. Well, I'm stopping and turning around. That's not what this is. So what we instructed people to do is, okay, walk to the end of the room and stop. I see a flat line in my movement. Then I turn around. That's some movement again. Stop, flat line. Then I start walking again. And we could use these flat lines in the data. I'll show them in a minute. We could use these flat lines actually to say, okay, this is where a person stopped and turned around. And so we'll forget about that. We did some variations, obviously, on this, because if you're catching a bus, you're not walking at your normal pace. You're running or walking faster. Or if you're shopping, you're not
rushing through the shopping mall. No, you're walking at a slower pace. And so
we looked at what if people walk faster or slower? What if they carry something?
What if they change their shoe type? Different shoes means different ways of walking. Data we collected looked like this.
Flat line is where somebody is standing still. It's not really a flat line, it's going a bit up and down because nobody stands exactly still and there is some noise on the center anyway. Somebody was standing still and then he started walking towards the end of the hallway, and then coming there, he stood still a bit. He turned around and you see there is movement there when I turn around, and stood still a bit again and then started walking again. Yeah, what we did is we just said, okay, we look just at this part. And then at this part, etc. So we could cut out the data that we wanted, where somebody was walking in a straight line at a normal pace in his normal way. What will influence your gait? I've given it away a bit already. What will influence your gait? Why will you walk different? What can you come up with? Sorry? Environmental stuff. Like what?
New shoes. If you break your leg.
Yeah. Injury. Yeah, injuries. Well, not. I don't have. If I'm breaking my leg, I'm probably not walking at all. But if I hurt my knee or if I strain my ankle, I will be walking different. Correct. What more?
Stolen your shoe.
Yeah. I think I'll count that as an injury. At least it hurts.
Weather.
Power off.
Yeah, thanks. Weather.
Yeah, based on the weather, I might, if it's raining, I might walk faster. But if it's slippery, I might walk more careful. Yeah, weather is a good one.
For example, in winter, you are using heavier clothing and then you use some...
different shoes, yeah. Different clothes.
Very good.
If it's flat or if you're walking up in nature?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as I said, walking upstairs is completely different, but even if it's a slope, yeah, you will notice that going uphill or going downhill will be different. Yeah, and as an extension to that, if I'm walking on inside on linoleum, or if I'm walking outside on grass or gravel or sand, all of those will be different. There are many circumstances. We didn't. I mentioned this already. Also with the video, if somebody is carrying a backpack, then the silhouette will be different. But that also holds with accelerometer data, because I'm. If it's a heavy backpack, maybe I'm leaning back a bit, and so my posture is different. Carrying heavy books or boxes, normally I swing my arms. If I'm carrying something, I might have to hold my arms in a different position. Not so heavy, but if I'm carrying a glass of water or a cup of coffee, I will be walking slightly more, slightly different.
State of mind.
Yeah, if I'm angry, I might walk different. Yeah, if I'm wondering about something, I might maybe just slow down or whatever. But yeah, that could be different. A different type of shoes. Yeah, if I'm wearing normal shoes or if I'm wearing these heavy boots in winter, if I'm wearing flip-flops or even barefoot, none of us, but if we're wearing heels, I hope none of us, if we're wearing heels, obviously that will be different. Different type of clothes also, if I'm wearing sports clothes or if I'm wearing in wintertime heavy coat and everything, extra pair of pants, or that will influence. This is for a single person. So this is all intra-person. This will all influence my gait. Which is not good, of course. We like something to be stable when we talk about biometrics. And we like differences between people also. Why? Because we have to be able to distinguish between people. So what? Why is your walking different from my walking? What will be the reason for that? What can you think about that? What's different between you and me that could influence my gait? Or our gait, I should say.
Right.
Yeah, posture, yeah. The physical build. Yeah. More?
gender influences the way that we walk. Women walk different from men. Learn behavior. In principle, it's something we learned over time. Yeah? Also, gait is something that you can adapt, but it's difficult. I had a friend who is was ice skating, speed skating. I have a friend, still my friend. And he wanted to be fast. He was very competitive. And he noticed when he was walking, his feet were like a bit apart. Not Charlie Chaplin, but slightly apart. But this doesn't really help you if you're figure skating. Speed skating. Yeah, it's best if your feet, or if your skates in that case, are perpendicular. No, not perpendicular, parallel. Yeah, if your skates are parallel, your feet are parallel. So he had to learn himself to not walk with his feet like this, but really put his feet like that. That took him a couple of months, maybe a year, to learn that. Yeah, because he was walking, no, wait, I'll have to have my feet straight. And he was walking, his mind wandering off, and he asked, every time he had to correct it. And only after a long period of training, he was able to, from then on, just walk with his feet parallel. So difficult to hide or to change your way of walking. So that about the settings in the experiment. I think I'll go for one break today, because it's quite early for the first break. I'll say something about gait data, and then after the break, I'll take the other parts. So the gait data that we collect, and I'm talking about accelerometer data. The data that we collect is actually acceleration in three different directions. We are moving in 3D space, so I'm actually also measuring the acceleration in these three directions. So that's obviously forward, backward. That is up and down movement, and that is left to right movement, or vertical, horizontal, and lateral. And so you get an acceleration will be three different values. What is the acceleration in the vertical direction? What's in the horizontal direction? And what is it in the lateral direction? And you get a three-dimensional vector in this case. So every single sample has three values. Acceleration, obviously you know, from distance and time, I can calculate speed. And from speed and time, I can calculate acceleration. And acceleration is often measured in meters per second square, or whatever. But we can also measure it in G forces, and 1G is simply 9.81 meters per second square around this area. Yeah, it changes a bit depending on the place you are. We were sampling the data at 100 samples per second, so every second generated 300 acceleration values. And we were walking in the old part where it was the library. So that's from here to the other side of the atrium. That's about the distance. A little over 20 meters. Took about 20 seconds. So 6,000. One walk all the way was about 6,000 values. At some point, not only for the phone, but also for the homemade equipment, it started changing direction. So the data that we collected was related to the orientation of the phone. So here we have a phone, and if I hold it straight up, then in this case the x direction is horizontal, the z direction is lateral, and the y direction is up down. Actually, I said that the acceleration in x and z, so in this plane, were zero, while the acceleration in the y direction, the up-down direction, is minus 1g. Well, I'm still holding the phone still.
Well, actually, what we are measuring was not acceleration. What we're measuring is gravity.
So this phone is pulled to the Earth with a particular force, which is the gravity. So that's why, even if I hold it still, we have a minus 1g. Minus 1g in this case because the plus direction is up and the minus direction is down. But what happens if I take my phone and I turn it? I'll have it in another orientation. Yeah, here I said the y direction is giving me a value of minus 1g. If I would turn my phone sideways, then all of a sudden the x direction is giving me plus 1g and the other two directions are. What happens when I'm walking? I have my phone in my pocket. It's not always like this. No, it's moving along with my leg. And so the x direction, what was the x direction? The x direction is the forward direction. Yeah, when I have it in my pocket. All of a sudden when I'm moving, there is part of the x direction and part of the y direction which is pointing in the forward direction. So calling x a forward direction at some point doesn't count anymore. If I'm following the Ministry of Silly Walks and really lift my leg, at some point actually y will be the forward direction and x will be the upward direction. And so we have to be careful how to interpret the data. But because we cannot anymore say that x is always going forward and y is going upward, up down, we have to solve this in some way. Well, one way we could solve this is by not looking at the acceleration in x, y, and z directions separately, but calculating this value, the resultant. So I'll square all these values, I'll add them, and then I'll take the square root of that. It's called the resultant. And actually, this resultant represents the magnitude of the total acceleration. I lost all the information about the actual direction, x, y, and z. I just represent the length, the amount of acceleration, the total amount of acceleration that this phone has. That's what I do. And because I do that, actually it doesn't matter how I hold my phone. If I hold my phone like this, and y and z are 0 and x is plus 1, yeah, then that this is plus 1 squared, plus 0 squared, plus 0 squared is 1 in total, and then the resultant vector will be 1. If I held it like this, then x and z was 0, and y was minus 1. So these two cancel, and this is minus 1 squared, which is 1. Take the square root, I still have 1. Hold it like that, doesn't matter. Even if I hold it like, tilted like this. And this is square root of 2 squared, sorry, square root of a half squared. Square root of a half squared and 0 squared. So half plus half plus 0 is again square root of 1. Yeah, so now all of a sudden the actual orientation of my phone is taken out of the equation. I just look how much acceleration I put on this device. So as an example in this particular case, we had the vector 2, 3, 5, so we get the length of that vector, which is approximately 6, slightly over 6. And if I know that the total acceleration is 6, I have no idea if that was actually in this direction, 2, 3, 5, or maybe in the complete opposite direction, minus 2, minus 3, minus 5. Also, that one will give the same resultant vector. Or in 5, 3, 2, any other direction. Yeah, a sphere around the origin, where this point is on the surface of the sphere. Any point on that sphere, on that ball, will have the same length, will have the same resultant vector. Yeah, that information on which point on that ball actually is the actual acceleration direction, I don't know, but I know that I have a total acceleration of 6.16. Other combinations have been tried for 3 or less of these acceleration values. People might say that, okay, when I'm walking, yet this phone is moving. And it's moving with my foot. But first of all, when I'm walking, it's moving forward. And it's moving upward. But this sideway direction, that's very little. I'm not swinging my hips a lot. So maybe I'll forget about the z direction. Take the resultant as a square of the acceleration in x and y direction. I'll forget about z.
That's a possibility. So I don't need to use all the X, Y, and Z information. Modern smartphones have other sensors also. They don't have just acceleration sensors like they had in the beginning. They now also have gyroscope sensors. Most of them have. And a gyroscope sensor somehow can give me information on how my phone is rotated. If I know how my phone is rotated, and I assume that in the beginning it was straight up, and I know that it now is rotated to be on a 45 degree angle, I can undo that movement. And I can get not, I can based on the acceleration data, the acceleration and the gyroscope data, I measure when my phone is like this. I can actually from that measure or calculate the forward and the upward acceleration. So I can just assume that I have a fixed coordinate system instead of one that is swapping around. When we talk about gyroscope data, we talk about yawn and roll and pitch. So those are the names that are given to that. Anyway, when we calculate the resultant vector of our acceleration data, we saw the long data. And we said, okay, we can identify the part where somebody is standing still. He's walking to the other side, and he's standing still at the other end again, with a number of cycles or number of steps in between. When we look at that, we get something like that, just that part. Standing still before we start to walk, then starting to walk, and at the very end, you're standing still again. Here we can see that the data is cyclic, right? If I start here, I'll go up, straight up, and then I'll go down into this W shape, go up into this M shape, and then go down again. If we do that here, we'll go up, go down in this W shape, up in this M shape, and down again. I see that everywhere. Yeah, there is variation. If I look at this, which one did I just have? This M shape in between here. Well, these two tops are very far apart, while here they're much closer together. So there is variation in each cycle. Of course, it's behavior. There is variation in that. We also see that the first step is it has that shape. We start at the bottom, we go up. We have something like a W shape here and an M shape there, and we go down again. But you see that the characteristics here are different from this one. The M shape is actually higher than this top here, while on the other side, because it doesn't happen. Here at the end, we have the same. We go up, we have the W shape, we have the M shape is one of the tops is really missing, and we go down again. Beginning and end of a walk are always slightly different. I'm standing still, and I'm going to walk. How do you start to walk? Have you ever noticed that? Have you ever thought about that? Yeah, you lean forward. You fall into the first step, right? Yeah, so that's causing some odd effects here. And what do you do at the end? You see a wall or a door or something, and you probably don't want to hit that wall. You don't want to walk into that wall. So at some point, you're physically preparing to stop. So okay, there's a wall. Okay, I'll stop. I'll do something different from the walk in the rest of the room. Yeah, so that's why the first... Well, this is the first cycle. The second cycle looks pretty okay. Yeah, I'm not sure if that is... There are some differences there. So the first few cycles are slightly different. The last few cycles are slightly different. Sometimes we just ignore the beginning and the ending, because that's not walking in your normal behavior. Yeah? One is falling into the first step, one is preparing to stop. Okay, so we have an accelerometer in this phone. Or maybe a special device with an accelerometer in it. Where should we put it on the body? What could be a good place to put this accelerometer to give us good data? Well, if it's a phone, I probably won't wear it around the hip. maybe in a pocket or whatever, around this area. Why? Well, I don't want to hide it in my shoe or something. If somebody rings it, it might be an odd situation. Yeah?
But suppose that we have a small sensor that we can place anywhere that we want. What would you think would be a good place to put such a sensor?
Ankle.
Yeah, ankle. Ankle or foot? You saw on the slide. Why? Why would that be a good place? Yeah, exactly. Well, you get when I swing in the swing phase, then suppose that it is in my right foot, in my right shoe, for example. Yeah, you get a full swing. You get a lot of acceleration. Yeah. On the other hand, in the stance phase, my foot is there, and suppose that it's on my ankle bone. Yeah, my ankle bone is just making a small movement. My foot is on my heel is on the floor, and my ankle bone is just making a small movement. Once I've done that, it's making a huge swing again. Yeah, so I can probably also distinguish between this swing phase and stance phase. I can see big differences between that. What more? Things are possible. I'll give shoulder. I've seen research where it's put on the shoulder or between the shoulder blades, actually. On the upper back. Why would I put it in the middle of my back, and why not, for example, here on my shoulder? Look at the ankle, for example. As I said, there is a huge difference between the stance phase and the swing phase. If I would have it in the middle of my body, actually that difference would go away. It's symmetrical. If I put it on the other side of my body, on this other ankle, actually the signal will be turned around. So having it on the shoulder or between the shoulder blades, yeah, I get a cycle which represents a single step instead of actually a left and a right step. I could hold it in my hand just as a usability thing. Yeah, I'm walking. I have my phone in my hands. Again, more theoretical or more specific. I could do it around the knee. Maybe I have something. A sensor above and below the knee. And maybe I can also measure how the knee bends. That could give me some interesting information, maybe. Maybe there is not a fixed position. Yeah, I'm carrying my phone always in my left pocket. Left, yeah. But it could move around. If the pocket is big, then yeah, it could turn around. Or maybe I'm carrying it sometimes in my hand or sometimes in my other pocket or in my back pocket or... So maybe we should do this independent of where somebody has a phone. And anyway, each of these positions has advantages and disadvantages. Either from a collecting data point of view or a user-friendliness point of view. Okay, now I think there is time for a break. Unless there are questions. No questions? Okay, then let's have a 15-minute break. Okay, let's discuss a method that was actually developed here in Jövik by a PhD student, Davron Jangavurov, together with some other people here. And he was the main person doing the research there. It's called the average cycle method. We just saw that in one walk, there were different cycles, and then what we'll do here is average them. Notice that I use a cycle and a walk in a particular way. A cycle is a left and a right step, that movement, or a part in the signal that keeps repeating. A walk is actually, from this point of standing still, going to the other side of the room, standing still again. So that's what I call a walk. We also have terminology a go, which is actually everything from walking several times. So that large data set that you saw, that I said we'll split up in different walks, that is what I call a go, but that's just terminology. So now average cycle method. Gait is, as I said in the beginning, gait is cyclic activity. And collecting data looks cyclic. It's not exactly cyclic as we saw, but there is clear tendency that this is a cyclic activity. And so what we'll do is we'll derive the cycle information from that full walk. So from walking from one way of the room to the other, we have different cycles, and we'll extract general cycle information of that. So what we can look at is how long is an average cycle? Not in the distance that I make the steps, but in the number of samples that I collect. That's how we measure length. And actually, it's a bit opposite, because if I walk slow, then it takes longer time to make a full cycle, which means I have more time to collect data, I have more samples. So if I walk slow, the length of the cycle will be longer, and vice versa. So the length of a cycle refers to the number of data points. And there is variation in it, but there is some kind of average for that. How high are the peaks? So we saw the resultant vector that was plotted. And obviously, if I have more acceleration, these values will be higher. So how high are its peaks? It's low and its top peaks. And obviously, we can look at the shape, so the full figure. So here we see a cycle, I think this is just a separate cycle, which is going up and then going down in this kind of V-shape, N-shape, whatever you want to call it here. And then we have something going up again. That was what we saw in the previous cycle also, except that going down we went into an M-shape followed by a W-shape followed by an M-shape going up and then going down. So we saw some of this structure also, but yeah, it's personal also. Obviously, there are some issues. These we discussed already. First and the last cycles are different. I'm falling into the first step, and I'm preparing to stop to not smash my face into the wall at the very end. So these cycles are different, and we might have to ignore them. And obviously, intra-person variability, also at a micro level, not just because I'm wearing different shoes. The shoes I was wearing when I started walking here and when I ended here, that's the same. I didn't change my shoes halfway the whole way, obviously. Yeah, and I didn't injure my leg all of a sudden. But there is anyway variation because, yeah, it's a behavioral activity and we don't behave like a robot. It's not exactly the same every time. So there is some variability on the cycle. Anyway, we can detect a number of cycles in this figure, and we can somehow capture those and calculate some kind of average of those. And so that's the average cycle method. There are actually five steps in there. The first step, that is the accelerometer data that we collect, is noisy. So there is some kind of noise on that sensor, maybe just because of some micro movements of the body or whatever, but we want to have a smoother signal than what we originally collect from the sensor, so we have to remove some noise. To reduce some noise. I can't remove the noise. Be aware of that. I reduce the noise. Once I've done that, the signal looks much smoother, and then I'm going to use that signal to detect all of the cycles. Where does the cycle start? Where does it end? And when it ends, the next cycle begins, and where does that cycle again end? Etc., etc.
Once I have that, I have actually split up my walk into the separate cycles. And then I need to do some kind of normalization. I can do some kind of normalization.
The length of the cycles could vary. So if I later on want to calculate some kind of average, yeah, then that might be an issue.
So what I could do is just squeeze all of the cycles or make all of the cycles have the same length in time, the same number of samples that I'm considering. Also, I could maybe do something with the amplitude and make some kind of normalization there also. Both of these are not mandatory.
Okay, once I've done that, suppose that I have created them all in the same length. I have, I don't know, my walk was 20 cycles. I'll just take the average of those 20 cycles in some way. And then once I have an average cycle from one walk, and I have an average cycle of the other walk, I can start comparing these average cycles. Yeah, and if these two walks were from the same person, I get something like a genuine score. And if these two walks were from different person, I get something like an imposter score. So graphically, it looks like this. We have the signal on top from two walks for the reference and for the probe. And here specifically, you see that the signal is very shaky. But then I do some noise reduction, and it gets a bit more smooth. In this, I'll start detecting the cycle. So the cycle here, you see here, it's a clear, let's say an M shape here. This shape is returning all of the time. Yeah? You see that returning? So that's where I detect where my cycle starts and stops. Yeah, and similar here. Shape is slightly different. Going up, straight down, and up. That, it's also kind of an M shape. It's returning all of the time. So again, I can detect where my cycle starts and stops. So this was the first step from here to here. It's the first step from here to here. The second step in the average cycle method. And then from here to here is actually the third and the fourth step. All of the cycles were normalized in this case to 100 samples. And then it's difficult to see, but all of these cycles are in this figure, but with a thin line. And then the average that was calculated from that is in the thick line. You see here, you can see some deviations from separate cycles. Then once I have an average cycle here, and I have an average cycle here, I can start comparing, and I get some kind of dissimilarity score. If you look at this, in my opinion, these are two different persons. I don't know the exact where the exact data came from, but this looks like two different persons. So let's have a look at all of these separate steps. Sensor data, as I said, contains some noise, so we need to reduce that. So here we have a... that's very clear to see. That's better. We have the signal that we collected, but it's kind of up and down, kind of noisy. And so we have to start doing some kind of noise reduction. No, yeah. See, that's the disadvantage of sitting in the back of the room. You can't see this. This is actually just a part of this cycle, but then enlarged.
If you follow, if you have the slides online, then you can... I didn't put them online yet. Sorry. I'll do that. But this is just a part of this large signal, so you have some more details. Yeah, but you see there that it is also noisy. And then we can start doing noise reduction. There are various methods. Moving average, weighted moving average are used a lot in our research. But I can also do something like filtering out specific frequencies. Maybe have a lower or a high pass filtering. This is a cyclic signal, so that's a low frequency. So maybe I should filter out the high frequency. So I should use a low pass filter most likely. Moving average filter, what does it do? If I'm looking at this sample, I'll just take some samples around it, and I'll take the average of those. Yeah, so I have this sample, and I replace it by the average of these five samples. I'll divide by, I have two samples to the left and two samples to the right, the two times two, plus the sample itself. I have five samples, so I divide by five.
Ah, this is better to see. Yeah, so the blue signal is the original signal, and you see that the red signal, the noise reduced signal, is
smoother.
You see also that peaks are significantly reduced, just the high peaks, because I have a data point here, and the other data points around it are much lower. And so that influences the average here.
In order to not have that huge effect of that huge peak reduction, we had the weighted moving average filter,
which puts weights on each of these coefficients. Yeah, and for the central point, I have a higher weight, and then I have smaller weights for points further away. And I'll divide by the sum of the weights. And then in green and blue, also a nice combination, you see that, again, the signal is smoother, but the peak reduction is less.
If you compare both,
you see that the original peak was here, the moving average puts it here, and that the weighted moving average that I use, but I could put higher weights, for example, on the center point, they leave it up here.
We have done tests with both kinds of noise reduction, and both work okay. The next step was detecting the cycles.
Next phase.
And actually, I can split that into various parts. You saw the signal, start with a flat signal where I'm standing still, and then the actual cycle start, where the first and the last cycle were slightly different. So what I first have to do,
first I want to determine the average length of the cycles, because I see a number of cycles, and I don't know, I have to have some hold point on, is this a fast walk or slow walk? How long is an average cycle? I'll need that later on. But once I have that, what I'll do is determine where the first cycle starts, and then based on that I know the average length of a cycle, I know approximately where it ends. And based on that information, I'll determine exactly where it ends. And then I repeat the third step. Why? Because if I know where the first cycle ends, I know where the second cycle starts, exactly at that same point. Yeah, so I only need to determine where the second cycle ends. Once I know where the second cycle ends, that's the same value as where the third cycle starts. I only need to determine where it ends again. Yeah, so this information is needed in this step. Determining then where the first cycle starts, and then I'm starting to use that information to determine where the next cycle starts or where that particular cycle ends, whatever you want to say. We have to look at the characteristics of the signal itself. Here, in this particular signal that I showed before, we saw that there were very clear, distinct minima. And so in this research we decided that a cycle goes from a minima to a next minima, a huge minima. We could have taken maybe also maxima in this case. That doesn't matter that much. We could have maybe taken a zero crossing. If we see a minima here, and we know that maxima is there, maybe we could have not a zero crossing, 1G crossing then. And we could also do that. And then we go from one zero crossing to the next zero crossing, or from one minima to the next minima, or from one maxima to the next maxima. That is something that you have to look at visually at a signal, or analyze a signal, and then determine, okay, this is where it's going to be. But the first step was determine how long the cycle is on average. If I have this signal, this walk signal, all the one that you saw before, and I overlay it with itself, and I calculate the correlation between the signal and itself, well, the correlation is then 1, because it's always a correlation between a signal and itself is 1. But what if I start moving this signal? The correlation will go down. But if I moved it exactly one cycle, then I might have a high correlation again. And if I would move it exactly 2 cycles, I have a high correlation again. So if I move the signal a multiple of a cycle length in either direction, I get a high correlation again between that moved signal and the original signal. And if I move it something else than a full cycle length, I get a lower value. That's what we're going to use. Actually, what we're going to do is not take that full signal and move it. We'll take a part of the signal and start moving that. Yeah, if my hands are the cycles and this is then one part of it, here I get a high correlation again, and then a low correlation, and then it gets high again, low, high, etc., etc. That's what we're going to do. So here is the original signal in black, but here in blue is the part that I'm going to move. And I don't know how long a cycle is, so in this case I just took 200 consecutive cycles from position 601 till 800 in this case. And if I moved that, that was correct. If I would have moved it all the way here, so this black signal, which is part of the original signal, I copied here and I displayed it in green. But I overlaid it over the original signal. And you see that actually the green signal and the original black signal, they match quite well. So I get a high correlation here. If I would have moved it here, again, that blue is copied and drawn in red here. You see that the black and the red are out of sync. And you will find a low correlation here. And so what I did is I'll take the blue one and I'll put it here at the beginning. And I look at the correlation between this part of the signal and my blue signal. And then I move it one sample. And I do it again, and one sample. And I do that all the way. Actually, if I put it exactly here, I get correlation one. Yeah? But if that signal matches what I see here, I get a high correlation. And if I plot all these correlations, you get something like this. So at some points, see high correlation. Here I see a correlation 1 exactly, because there I had an exact overlay of that blue part with the original signal. And this I think was the other one that I showed, the
green one.
But if I look where these peaks are, the high correlation peaks, where is that after how much, at which sample? I found these locations. See, 601 is where it was exactly 1, because that sample was that part, the blue part was from sample 601 to 800. This doesn't say a lot, but now I look at the differences. Because here I apparently detected that, I have a good, I moved it, and how to put that? I get a high correlation here, and if I move it from sample 138 to 255, I get a high correlation again. So apparently I moved it one cycle length, or approximately one cycle length in that direction. And if I move it to sample 370, again one sample, one cycle length, I get a high correlation again. So I look at the difference between these detected locations, detected peaks, and we see that all of these are approximately the same. So the distance between 138 and 255 is 117. Between 255 and 370 is 115. 117 was the first one. Yeah, 115 again, et cetera, et cetera.
And so from this, I calculate the average, and I say the average
cycle length of these values is 116.
Sure, it was 116.3, but that's okay.
So detecting a cycle length, or approximate cycle length, is a matter of looking at taking a part in the middle and moving it, looking at where the high correlations occur, detecting where those locations are, and then looking at the difference between consecutive values and taking some kind of average from that. Then the next step, so the first step in the cycle detection was find the average cycle length. We just did that. The next step was determine where the first cycle starts. Remember, in the beginning, we had a flat signal, and then we started walking, and these cycles started appearing. The flat signal was at approximately 1 G.
because we're measuring gravity, right? When I start walking, all of a sudden this acceleration will go up. And so what I did here is, this is 1.2, I look where the signal for the first time gets over 1.2 g, the acceleration value. And in the beginning, when I'm standing still, it will not happen. I should not take 1.1 g or something like that, because then by accident I might make a small movement and I get over that. Yeah, I'll start waiting until the signal for the first time gets over 1.2 g. And here are two red dots. So this is a data point and this is a data point. And in this data point, the first one, I was just below 1.2 g. And here I'm just above 1.2 g. So this one is the point that I was looking for at this location. From here, I will look further on one average, one expected cycle length, the one that I just calculated. So from here, I'm looking 116 samples further. And in this area, I'm going to find my maximum. Because I decided to look for maxima. I look at the signals at maxima are very distinct. Minima could be some discussion about it. I look at maxima. So between here and here, I look at where the maximum is, and that is actually this point. So this I define as the start of my first cycle. And we already can see this cycle here. So this is where it ends, right? So how are we going to determine that? So that we want to detect the end of the first cycle, which is the start of the second cycle. I'll make some definitions. I'll define point P1 as the index where that cycle started, which I just determined. I'll define P1 as where it will end, just to have some notation. What we expect, if this was, let's say, 100, then we expect that this will probably be somewhere around 216, right? Because the expected cycle length was 116. So if this was an index of 100, it's probably at 216 more. But it might not be exactly there. So this is what we expect, but there could be some deviation. We expect this to be so much more than where it started. But because we know that there is some variation, we're not looking exactly at that point. We're actually looking at that point, but some slack around it. I'm not saying I'm exactly looking for that. I'm looking in the surroundings of that. How does that look? This is where it was. Now this index, I go 116 indexes further, which is this dotted line. So now, well, it is in this area. I'll look around that dotted line. I don't know what kind of slack. I think I took 20. It can be 20 samples to the left or 20 samples to the right. 20 samples earlier or 20 samples later. And yes, in this area, I then look for that maximum again, because I'm looking for maxima. And there it is. Okay, that's my, so P1 is actually slightly more than the average cycle length further than P0. So the exactly would be here, well, this is a bit more even. But the next one might be a bit shorter, we don't know. Once I've detected that here the next cycle starts, I can repeat this process, yeah? From this point, I look 160 samples further with some wiggle room around it. And in that wiggle room, I'll find the maximum again. And then I'll continue doing that. So here, oh, again, barely visible. In red was the cycle that it just detected. Yeah, now I'll repeat this over and over again until I reach the end of the data. The first and the last cycle was slightly different, so I might run into trouble. Maybe I'm getting out of sync and it's because of this. Maybe there is some strange things happening in between. Maybe I started a bit. Maybe I fell halfway. Not fell, but stumbled. Yeah, and that might be a sample in there that is odd and which is might be longer than I expect. I might not detect them, I'm getting out of sync. So what I can do is I can start at the end of the beginning of the signal and work towards the end. I can start at the end of the signal and work backward, same procedure. or I can start in the middle and then work both ways. Yeah. I can consider minima instead of maxima. That all of that is free. Depends on the shape of the signal. I run into trouble when there are multiple maxima and minima close together. I will show an example in the next slide. When the cycle length changes, I might run into trouble. Or when this minima or maxima is not in this range. So I have this where I expect it to be and have some wiggle room around it. But what if the actual maxima or the actual point what I want to detect is even outside that? I have to be able to solve that too. Let's look at this, where there are multiple minima in this case together. So here I have two minima, of which this one is the absolute lowest, and here where the first one is the absolute lowest, and here I have it as it should be, just a single one. Yeah, if I just say I look for the absolute minimum, I will detect this as the start of a cycle, and this as the end of the cycle, and so the start of this new cycle that goes up to here. So one cycle is the red one, which is the first one, and then the blue, the black one is the second one, which starts here with this strange thing in between. Yeah. Making sure that this cycle detection is performed in the best way will give you the best results in the end. Because if I start averaging the red and the blue the red and the black cycle, well, here at this part it seems to be okay. But here, yeah, average probably is going wrong somewhere, depending on how I do it. Making sure that the cycle detection is at the best of its abilities will give you the best results in performance of gate recognition afterwards. I had a student who was doing, a master student who was doing, was paying a lot of attention to this particular phase, and he got actually the best results that we got so far in gate recognition at that point in time. Much lower than what others got. In the first step, we detected the average cycle length. And actually, the average cycle length is a bit person-dependent, of course. I tend to walk rather fast, so my average cycle length will be short, because I don't need a lot of time for these two steps. That means less samples. There are people that in their normal pace, that walk a bit more relaxed and they will take a bit longer, and so their cycle will be longer. So for normal walking, the same student as I discussed before, he detected that on average is somewhere between 95 and 125 samples. He also looked at faster and slower walking. Fast walking means that my steps are going faster, so my cycle is getting shorter. Fast walking, the average cycle length was between 80 and 110. Notice that there is an overlap. That somebody walking fast might actually be walking slower than somebody in his normal pace. But that's because it's person dependent, of course. Slow walking was between 110 and 180. And again, there is overlap with normal walking, but there is nobody saying that he was walking slow, while he was still faster than somebody else who was saying that he was fast. Probably somebody who has an average slow walking in this range will also be in these ranges here, and same there. Okay, so we detected the average cycle length. We extracted the cycles actually from the full walk signal. So that was that second step. Then the third step was to do normalization. And note here that we can do normalization, both in amplitude and both in the y direction and in the x direction, time and amplitude. But we don't need to do that. It might be easier for averaging and comparing, but again, there are solutions to that also. You lose information. Obviously, you lose information. If I take a cycle, and all the cycles, whatever cycle I get, I'll make sure that it is 100 samples in the end, whatever I start with. Somehow I squeeze it or I stretch it out, but it's 100 samples at the end. I lose information.
I lose the fact that somebody might be a fast walker and have smaller cycles or slower on average when he's walking in his normal speed, have a longer cycle. That is information that I'm losing when I'm doing normalization. Also, if I'm doing normalization in the amplitude, I lose information. And normalization in the amplitude direction is simply scaling. If it's going from A to B, I scale that down to 0 to 1 or something like that, whatever you want. Time normalization is a bit more difficult. We don't want to just cut off part at the end of the cycle, because then, I'm missing a lot of information, missing significant information. I want to squeeze that signal that is too long. The signal that is 120 samples long, I want to squeeze it into 100 samples. Not by removing samples in between, but by doing linear interpolation. I want to stretch another one. If you're doing time normalization, we can either say beforehand, whoever walks, whatever this person is doing, everything will be 100 samples. So very independent of the user, a global setting. Or we can see the signal we saw before. We saw that the average cycle length of this person was 116. So all of these cycles, yeah, the first one was a bit longer, we saw that. But I'll squeeze that into 160. And the cycle that was a bit smaller, I'll stretch that to 160. I'll keep that as a characteristic of this particular walk. So I can do that on a per walk or per user basis, such that I at least have some information. But then my average cycle might be 95 samples long, and your average cycle might be 112 cycles long. Then I get, again, in terms of comparison, how do I compare? Linear interpolation, not sure if you are aware of this. Suppose that I have two measurements. At time t0, I have a measurement of a0, and at time t1, I have a measurement of a1. So that looks like this in a figure. So these are real measurements, but I want to know what would have been the measurement at time t. And I assume that the measurements go up linearly. Linear interpolation can tell me that right away. I'm not going to derive it. The value of a, yeah, that value that I'm interested in, is actually a0. That's a starting point. Plus some scaling factor. a1 minus a0 divided by t1 minus t0 times time t that I want, t minus t0. How can you check if this is correct? Yeah, Google it, but it's a straight line. So if I know in two points that this formula is correct, it will be correct in all the points because it's linear in t. Yeah, it's some kind of constant here, and this times this is some kind of constant, and the only time that t arrives is here. What if t is t0? I should be getting the value a0. Right? If I fill in t is t0, then this is 0. As something multiplied by 0, drops out, and I get the result a0. Same if I would plug in t1, I should get the value a1. So t1 minus t0, oh well, that cancels against this one. So this cancels, and I get left with a0 plus a1 minus a0. Okay, then the a0 also cancels. I'm left with A1. So I check that it is correct in two points. It's a linear relation in the variable t, so it's correct in all points. Linear interpolation might be a bit rooted. It's kind of hooky. So higher polynomial interpolation could also be done, but again, in the research that we've done, we've selected a lot of simple methods. Linear interpolation, simple moving average, weighted moving average, noise reduction, and all of that worked pretty well already. So I don't need to go to more complicated low-pass filtering. I don't need to go to third-degree polynomial interpolation or whatever. So here I have my original signal. I don't know how long the signal was. It was n values, n samples, but I want to squeeze it into, in this case, 100 samples. OK?
capital T0 up to capital T99, those are my timing information. And I want them to be equally spread. The beginning and the end of the cycle, I'll keep the same. So this value is the same as this one, and the last value is the same as this last value. But all of these values in between, I want to use the linear interpolation. Well, first I define the timing values, which I spread out equally between T0 and T99. Yeah, that the area in between is the same. Again, is this formula correct? If I plug in I is 0, then this reduces to 0 because I'm multiplying by 0 and I get T0 is T0. That's pretty okay. If I plug in 99, T99 is, well, I multiply and I divide by 99, so that cancels. Then the minus T0 cancels against T0 and I get, again, what I want. Easy checks for these kinds of formulas. So I now have capital T0, I have capital T99, and all the data in between is equally spread out, right? Up to, let me, T98. And the original signal started at T0 up to Tn minus 1. It had a different spreading, also equally spaced, but yeah, this distance could be smaller or larger. So this could be T1, T2, T3, etc. Yeah, but the original signal, this was the original signal from these values. I have to now sample at these times, capital T1, capital T2, etc. And I just use linear interpolation. If I want the value here connected to a particular Ti value, I look at these small t values and see in between which one they fall. And then I use that to use the linear interpolation between those points to calculate the correct value. Anyway, that's just some mathematics. Don't worry too much about it. Many implementations for that. But then we go to the next step. We started with our walk. We split it up in cycles after doing some noise reduction. And all the cycles are now nicely, let's say, 100 samples long, just for the example. And we did time normalization. So here are my cycles. I detected in my walk, I detected M cycles apparently. So cycle 1 is C11, C12, up to C100. It's 100 samples long, up to the last one, which is these values. Yeah, the timing value now, this is just the acceleration, the resultant acceleration value. And I forgot about the timing value. That's no longer relevant. I get 100 sample values. But I want to get some kind of average of this. Of these M cycles, I want to calculate an average. And this A1 should be the average of these values. This A2 should be the average of these values. A3, et cetera, all the way up to the end. Yeah. And we're doing the same thing as in keystroke dynamics. Yeah, except there we talked about duration, latency, et cetera. Here we talk about acceleration values. No difference. In keystroke dynamics, we had a number of typings of one password. Here we have a number of cycles from a walk. So the way to calculate the average again is in the very same way. We can take mean, median, mean with outlier, whatever you want. If we decided not to do time normalization, I can't apply this process, of course. I need some other way to find an average. I could probably use dynamic time warping to do this. Yeah, but that's a complicated process. Here we see what happens. The thin lines are the original cycles, and the black line, the thick black line, is actually the average of those. And you see that the shape of the thick black line, the average, follows
the cycles very, very closely. Yeah, there is some deviation, obviously. Here, this first cycle, hard to see, had the maximum here already. Well, that is nicely cancelled because of this averaging.
Yeah, because all the other
peaks were all close together here.
Yeah. So we have an average cycle which represents all the cycles in that walk in a nice manner. So we have somebody walking, and he walks a number of times in one go. Then I'll split the one go up into several walks. I'll split each of the walks up into several cycles, and I'll take from each walk, I'll calculate then that average cycle. So me going from one way of the room to the other is now reduced to one average cycle. And then you, doing the same, is reduced to one cycle. And when I walk back, again, that walk was reduced to one average cycle. But then we have to start comparing. So I have my average cycle from, let's say, walking one way, and I have my probe from walking backwards, or maybe the probe from somebody else walking forward or backward or whatever. And we have to make some comparison. Any distance metric is okay here. Whatever you want to use. Manhattan distance works okay. Very simple metric. You just look per point, what is the difference? And if I have one average cycle that looks like this, and another average cycle that looks like this, was a bit short anyway. I'll just look for every sample point. I look at the plenty of colors. I look at the difference, and I'll add up all these differences. Yeah, over all these 100 cycles. That's Manhattan distance. Euclidean distance, I again look at all these differences, but I'll take the average of the squared ones. So I'll square these differences. And then I'll take the square root of the sum of those. I can use dynamic time warping also, trying to match, to see how I have to change the red signal to match it to the black signal. How that is done. Here, for example, you see that this peak comes way before this peak. Yeah, so probably in the red signal, I have to delete a number of samples to move that peak backward. Other distance metrics work well. Which one works best? That's a matter of testing. These are timing signals. Note that. This is walking. And walking is done something that is done over time. So these are timing signals. We found that dynamic time warping does have a good performance, better performance than others, but it is a very lengthy procedure, so it's not really fast. If I look at the signal, and this is just one cycle, if I would draw all the cycles from a walk of this particular person, I might see that the information between point C and D is very much, there is a lot of variation in there. But at this first part between A and B, or the part between B and C, or both, there is very stable. Then I can just use that part to do the comparison. I can forget parts of the data. I don't need to calculate the distance over all 100 samples. I can select parts where I know that the user is very stable. We can have some variations to this average cycle method. In the beginning, we said we had one walk, we find all the cycles, and we average. We have another walk, we find all the cycles, and we average. And then we compare the averages. Suppose that I have done that procedure for the reference. I have my average cycle for my reference. But for the probe, I detected these P cycles already, but then I stop. I don't start averaging these M cycles from the probe into one average cycle. That's what I did before. I don't want a variation now. This is a cycle, and this is a cycle.
So I can calculate the distance between these two. And this is a cycle, and this is a cycle, so I can calculate also the distance. So now I can calculate the distance between the average cycle from the reference and each of the separate cycles of my probe. Obviously, I have to repeat this distance calculation now m times instead of 1, instead of just taking these, smashing them together to one average and then calculating one average cycle. Now I have to repeat that distance calculation m times. But I get m distances, d1 up to dm, and then based on that I make a decision. So if I'm walking, suppose that this was indeed my reference and my probe, and I'm walking and halfway in between, I stumble a bit and I get a strange, one or two cycles which are strange. Then most of these distances will be small, because it's my reference and my probe. Some of them will be larger. That stumble could have messed up my average cycle from the probe, and could have led to not recognizing me. But in this case, I get a lot of small values, and maybe one or two higher values. I could just overlook that fact. Okay, most of it, I have 15 values which say it's the correct person, but two values that say that it's not the correct person. Yeah, probably a stumble or something. So we don't need to do that averaging. It makes things faster, but it is not needed. I can do the same for the reference. Yeah. I can just keep all the cycles in the reference. Or I can do both. I can keep all the cycles in the reference and all the cycles in the probes. I have to do a lot of comparisons then, but okay. Okay. I'm talking for 3/4 of an hour again. So let's keep the mimicking until after the break. Questions? All clear? Good. Okay, then let's have a 15-minute break then.
let's go over to mimicking. I guess I'll bring that again, because there will be some graphs you hardly can see. As said, in behavioral biometrics, we have to, in any biometrics, you have to see if spoofing, or in this case we call it mimicking, isn't too easy. Because if mimicking is easy, yeah, then actually the particular modality cannot be used as a biometric modality to distinguish between people. So we had actually three students doing research on this here. First is a PhD student. Second was a master's student from Huygé at that point in time. And the third was a master's student from NTNU, which is a couple of years back. So he came from Trondheim here to do research on that. The first one, the PhD student, he had a relatively simple setup. He had had 100 people in the experiment. He paired them up in groups of two. And in each group of two, both of them played the victim and both of them played the attacker. They just switched. And each attacker had four mimicking attempts. In two of these attempts, the victim was walking in front of him or her, and the attacker could just adjust his walking based on what he saw happening just in front of him. In the second two attempts, the attacker had to walk a lot and had to try to remember. So you see, it's very, very little effort that they actually put in the mimicking. And so walking one way behind the victim, walking back behind the victim, and then going up and down once more. So little effort. And actually the conclusion was that mimicking under these circumstances was not possible. He had done a baseline experiment. You see the black one is the friendly scenario where everybody is just walking like himself. And you see that in the hostile scenario where the mimicking was, the ER is very, very, very little bit smaller, but hardly noticeable, hardly relevant. So that little change is not really relevant. So the conclusion was mimicking is not possible under these circumstances. One of the conclusions that he did also draw from this research was that if you want to attack somebody from your own gender. It's easier to mimic a male, in our case, than a female. So that was the first. That was one of the first research that was actually done on the security of gait biometrics. The next one was a master's student, and he was taking a different approach. There, you could not see the victim walking, but you could see the acceleration data of this person. So normally we have a device that would collect acceleration data and later on we'll transfer it to the computer and see that. He uses a slightly different device that could transfer the acceleration data directly to the computer where you could show it on online ready. So this was a setup, this was a roof. Somebody would walk towards a wall and at the end of the wall there was a big screen. He had a sensor that would transmit the acceleration data to the computer, which would then project it right there and then on the screen. So you get a signal of the victim in black here, and the signal in red was from this person walking. The walking distance was very small, actually from that side of the room to that side of the room, that's all. There was a table there, so you could not really walk into the wall. So yeah, it's a very small, like five cycles, let's put it like that. He used correlation between the signal from the victim and the signal from the attacker to determine if this was the correct person. And he had 13 participants plus he played himself the victim. So he had 13 other participants trying to mimic him. We already know that this might not be the best distance metric or comparison metric. Why? We know that if we have a signal that is exactly the same and in sync, we get a high correlation. But if the signal is more or less the same but slightly out of sync, then the correlation will be low. And so even if I would walk exactly like somebody but slightly out of sync with in comparison to the signal here,
I'm getting a low score. And because it's just five steps, I don't get the opportunity to get into sync. Before I get into sync, I'm hitting the wall already.
So in that respect, the setup wasn't the best. So immediately feedback to the attacker, but the short distance gave no room for adjustments of my or getting into sync with the victim.
He calculated the correlation score and showed it here. These are everywhere two signals. This is XYZ acceleration and the resultant signal. So this is the one that we would watch anyway while doing that.
And that is probably also hard to see.
Yeah. On the sides, you will see that here the signal is indeed different. So he gets a lower score.
This was some similarity distance, by the way, not the dissimilarity distance. His conclusion was mimicking is easy.
But my footnote here is this is just under these circumstances.
Yeah. So don't, personally, I would say don't put too much weight on this particular research, but I just wanted to mention it. Because it's one of the three research on gait mimicking. The third one was from a student from, in that time, NTNU in Trondheim, because there was no NTNU in Jurvik then. And he did a very extensive attack scenario. He had 50 participants, and he did a baseline experiment where everybody walked a number of times, apparently 10 times. So up, down, and that repeated 5 times in the distance of 20 meters, so the distance of the atrium approximately. Two of these walks were even videotaped. So he was measuring acceleration anyway, but on top of that he was videotaping. One videotape was from the side, so you saw somebody, he was following, you saw somebody walking. And the other one was from behind. And he used as distance metric dynamic time open because he knew already from previous research that we had done here that gave good results. Doing this in the baseline, so no mimicking yet, he got an equal error rate of 6.2%. But it's not about optimizing that value, I have to say that. Then he had actually two mimicking scenarios. The first one was short-term mimicking scenario. He selected one victim, me, and then he selected three, now this should be 2+2+2 attackers. 6 attackers in total. And how did he select it? First of all, the attackers should be motivated. The idea was that they spent a considerable amount of time on this experiment. Yeah, and so if you're watching your clock all of the time, you're not motivated, you want to do something else. These were attackers that wanted to devote time and get good results, wanted to break the system, wanted to walk like the victim. Of these 6 attackers, 2 of them had already a walking pattern relatively close to the victim. 2 of them were at moderate distance, and 2 of them were far away. So the walking pattern of these 2 last attackers was different from the victim. Why was that? Because he wanted to maybe draw a conclusion like it's easier to radically change your walking pattern or to maybe just make small adjustments. Yeah. But the most important thing is that they were motivated.
Each attacker had 5 mimicking sessions. And each of these mimicking sessions took approximately 1 hour. So they really had to devote a lot of time to this.
And so it's not like walking 2 times behind it or walking this distance 15 times or whatever, like in the other research.
In each session, the video recordings of the victim were discussed, were looked at. Particular points of the walk were taken into consideration, like how are the arms moved, how are the legs moved, how are the feet standing, etc., etc. Oral instructions were given, and within each of these 5 sessions, an attacker had somewhere between 12 and 18 walks with a lot of oral feedback. Actually, this was split, each session was split in 3 goes, and in each go, there was 4 or 6 walks. So that's why we get to 12 to 18 walks.
Yeah, and between goes and before the first go, there was discussion on, okay, now we look at the video, now we look at how you walk, et cetera, et cetera. So there was extensive feedback already. Per session, there was a different focus. First two sessions was high-level information. How are the arms swinging? How is the leg standing? How is the posture? These kinds of things. So the let's say the overall, the easy to see things in a walk. Relatively easy to also adjust. Yeah, if you normally walk with your arms like this and you see that the victim is swinging, okay, that's easy to adjust. Yeah, the exact stand of the feet or the exact movement of the hips, these are things that are more difficult to adjust. Third session was a live imitation attack where they were walking behind the victim, and there was a videotape even of that. So they could live adjust their pace to the victim. The attacker could do that. And there was a videotape also of that from different angles where that could be analyzed later again. In the fourth session, they tried to do some fine-tuning of different details of the walking, and then the last one was, just free for the attacker to adjust whatever he wanted. So here are some information. The victim was subject 16, and actually here you see seven attacks, but attacker one, which was the student himself, he did a long-term experiment. Mimicking experiment, and the other ones were the short-term experiment attackers. So we have gender, age information, weight, and height, because as you said, that could be interesting also. This is the dynamic time warping distance on average and with the standard deviation within the baseline experiment. Yeah, within the baseline experiment, the victim had a dynamic time warping signal between his own reference and probes of 4.73 on average with a standard deviation of 1.75. So this attacker, for example, had in that baseline experiment a start distance of 9.79 with a variation of 1.18. So that was the one, these two were the ones that were considered close by, so the first two. And the one with distance 19 and with distance around here 13, these were considered the two that are have a very different walk from the victim. And the other two had around 12. CLA was the average number of samples in a cycle. So in the victim it was 107, here it was 107.5, but this one had 110, for example. So he was walking a bit slower. But no major differences there. If I look at the details for attacker three, so for this person, which was on average already very close to this victim, yeah, here you see that how he started. Then he had five sessions, each of them is three goes, so session one, session two, three, four, and five. And within each session, he had within each go, he had 4 to 6 walks, and the average distance that he managed in these sessions is here. Given with the black line. And you see, actually, if you look at these values, that, he was not really getting any improvement. Actually, when he was doing his own normal walking, he was closer to the victim than when he was trying to mimic. And depending on here, there was a focus on global features, and it was going up and down. Here, when there was a focus on some more detailed features, it was a bit more stable. But this one, for example, never managed to mimic the victim sufficiently. These were the two that were closest, so this is the same as on the previous slide. This is the other one that was also close. And you see here, in the beginning he was maybe a bit unsure about what he was doing, but then at some point it seems to be going down a bit, but then he's losing it again. And this was a common thing here, because once people start to focus on too much details, it actually could go wrong. Here for the two ones, let's say at a medium distance,
you could say that there might be, if you do linear regression, that it might be a downward sloping trend there. But even that is after 5 hours of training, it's not really that much improvement. The big improvement was actually from, this was a lady who had a huge distance in the beginning, in the friendly experiment, the baseline experiment. So her walking was completely different. But once she started trying to walk like the victim, see that she pretty much improved. Yeah, except that here in one case something went wrong. It's not that important. When we look at the total number of mimicking attempts of these six attackers, there were 400 mimicking attempts altogether. So 400 walks which we processed. Out of these, based on the threshold that gave the 6.2% equal error rate, that threshold was also used in the mimicking experiment, and there were 32 attempts which actually ended up with a threshold or with a distance below that threshold. And then you see that is a success rate of 8%, while the equal error rate was 6.2%. So actually, didn't really help in trying to actively mimic. The best result was for attacker A80, and I'm not sure which one that was in this. But he had actually in one of these goes in the fourth section, he was every time better than he was below the threshold. So all of his walks would have been accepted as being from the victim. But after that, he lost it again. Two of these attackers never managed to mimic the victim. The conclusion, based on also other things, was that learning is possible, but up to some level. At some point, you apparently hit some kind of boundary. I can improve myself a bit, but then it's over. When I'm then trying to change something else, something that I learned before, because I just did it a couple of hours. I'm not training this for a month on row. Yeah. When I change something new, I'm falling back to my old habits with something that I changed before. And so I didn't improve. He himself did a long-term mimicking, where he had 168 attempts in total to mimic the victim. He did that for 6 weeks, approximately 10 hours per week. So he was, while the others were just doing 5 hours, which is a lot already, certainly compared to the other research, he was spending 60 hours in analyzing video, making changes maybe to shoes or whatever, to see if that would have an influence. And all the walking, looking at the video, looking at the data, anything that he could. But in the end, these are all his 168 distance values. And you see that here at some point he seemed to get a hold of it. But then he lost it again. And then there was a lot of variation going up and down. The threshold for acceptance was somewhere around between 7 and 8. Or between 8 and 8.5 or something like that. So he never actually managed to mimic the victim. So he observed that there are natural boundaries on the mimicking capabilities of an attacker. And in his long-term attempt, he also hit such a boundary. And then by training more and more and more, because he spent 60 hours on this, he managed to actually break that, but then he hit another boundary. New boundaries will be met after that. So the general conclusion was that an attacker can learn up to some level, but if he's overwhelmed with too many details, he will fall back to his own old behavior. Any questions about the mimicking? Anybody interested in spending 60 hours? It's a lot, right? So it's not like the other attempts. This was a real attempt to break a system. Let me spend two slides on potential applications. We talked about the phone already, and a phone can measure my acceleration. Maybe even gyroscope if I want to include that. So my phone can measure how I walk. So how can we use that? We can actually use it in two different ways. We talked about continuous authentication already.
If my phone, we talked about continuous authentication with using keystroke dynamics, and then we said if I'm using my computer and I detect that the keystroke dynamics is deviating from what I expect, I lock the computer. Here we can do the same. We can use gate for security. When the phone is being used, but it detects that the walking is incorrect, it could make a decision to lock the phone. We could also use it as a user friendliness feature. When I'm not using the phone, I can also measure how I'm walking. And what happens? Everybody has a pin on their phone, obviously. I hope. Yeah? Could be that I'm having it in my pocket, I'm walking, and all of a sudden I think, oh, I need to check something. So I'll take it out, and then I have to give my pin code. Yeah? But we could use it as a user friendliness feature where if during the walking the phone detected that, yeah, this is the real owner, maybe I don't need to give the pin code. Maybe it will open up already right away. Or maybe when I'm going to my office and my computer is there, I have the phone in my pocket, I'm walking up to my office, and the phone detects that this is correct walking, and all of a sudden there is a Bluetooth signal saying, hey, I noticed that the owner's computer is nearby. I just verified that the walking pattern is compliant with my owner. I can send a signal that this device opens. Yeah, so a user friendliness. I'm in this case, I'm getting access because of correct walking. In this case, access is taken away because of incorrect walking. I can use both. So that's one way of using it. The other way that it has actually been used is in machine vision based, where the closed circuit television systems, CCTV systems, they were capturing criminals. And if you're robbing a bank, if somebody is robbing a bank, then what they generally do is they have gloves on. So they're not leaving fingerprints. And they're having something over a ski mask over their head or a helmet or something, so we can't see their face. But we can, on video, analyze their walking. Yeah, and they can do some silly walks and obscure that, but most don't think about that. So most go in, walk into a bank in their normal way, without thinking of if they're walking in a normal way, actually. Yeah, but they walk, and we can capture that video, and we can use that that has been used in court cases where a criminal who was caught on another occasion, the gait of him or her was compared to what was captured on another crime. And based on that, they got convicted for those. It's often hard to shield your way of walking. And also, if you're actively trying to walk differently, when you're robbing a bank, you're probably thinking about different things than walking in an odd manner. Yeah, you will fall back easily into your own manner of walking. We could also use that, for example, at an airport, where maybe it's not easy to see faces of people, but based on that gait, we could follow that. Obviously, with a number of challenges, because you're not the only one walking at the airport, there are a few more people walking there. So tracking a person there could be challenging. Okay, those were the promised two slides. Any questions? If not, then at 1:15 there will be the practical session again. Okay? Then I'll see you there.